Today in Your Health, we're going to look more closely at one of the building blocks of good science, placebos. You probably know them as sugar pills. For decades, placebos have played a major role in medical experiments and tests. But as NPR's Elise Spiegel reports, it looks like our response to placebos is changing over time.
A long time ago, when they were still young, Annette Dashner and her husband George decided to go for a walk in the park. It was a beautiful day, the sun was shining, everything was perfect. Or anyway, everything except for George's arm.
When we were in the park, his left arm wasn't moving, and he was walking, and one arm just wouldn't move, you know, when you usually walk. So anyway, I noticed, why isn't your arm walking? She says, I don't know, but my little pinky here is twitching, and I don't understand what that is.
Annette encouraged George to see a doctor about his pinky, and so he did. But the doctor had bad news. George had Parkinson's.
And I said, no, it can't be. He was crying. I was crying. It felt like the end of the world. It felt like a death sentence.
At that point, George was 40 years old, the father of four young children. It was horrible. Annette Dashner says that there was only one very small ray of hope, science.
They told him it's a very, very slow progressing disease. It gives you time for scientists to come up with better cures, better treatments, perhaps one day a cure.
And so Annette and George waited for one day. Then, several years later, one day seemed to come. There was an experimental study. A doctor in Colorado was injecting fetal tissue into the brains of people with Parkinson's. The experiment was relatively safe, but there was one catch. 40 people would be accepted into the study, but only 20 would get the real operation. 20 would get a placebo operation. They'd go through everything that the real patients went through without getting the fetal tissue. Why go through the trouble? Because the doctor knew that even fake surgery, placebo surgery, will often give people relief. So to find out what the real operation might do for his patients, he felt he needed to compare the effect of the real operation with a fake one. George agreed and flew to Colorado for an elaborate surgery.
They put a crown on your head, screw it into your skull, because your head has to be real still.
So then how many holes did they drill?
Four holes. Four holes was drilled into his skull.
Now, eventually, George Dashner found out that he did not have the real operation. He got the placebo. And you might think that once told, he'd be a little put out about the four holes in his head. But his wife, Annette Dashner, says no. She says she and her husband understand just how important placebos are.
This is science. How they ever do it, I don't know. But this is the way science works.
It's true. Over the last four decades, placebos have come to play this huge role in medical research. And to understand more about that role, I called a researcher at Harvard University named Arthur Barsky. I needed Barsky to explain why it is that placebos, the proverbial sugar pill, the fake operation, why these things seem to make people better when there's absolutely nothing to them. Barsky told me that one big reason is conditioning.
You've learned over the course of your lifetime that going to the doctor, being examined, having him write out a prescription, waiting in the line at the pharmacy, taking a pill, that that's generally followed by some benefit. So you've kind of learned a pattern of reacting that seems to be pretty powerful.
So the mere fact of participating in these activities often makes you feel better. Now, this is incredibly important when it comes to drug trials, studies that try to figure out whether or not a drug is working. Researchers feel that because of this placebo effect, they can't just give their drug to patients, then ask how they feel.
The question really is your new medication more effective than a sugar pill?
Which is why, when there's a drug study in this country, much of the time the drug is compared to a placebo. But, says Barsky, this whole system is premised on some pretty big assumptions about the ways that placebos work. You see, we really think of placebos as stable.
We have always assumed that it was a pretty constant effect, that the same person would have the same response to a placebo at different points in time, that similar illnesses would respond in a similar way to placebo. It was a constant, predictable, stable, and very important phenomenon that you saw in any medical interaction.
But it turns out that the placebo effect might not be as stable as we've assumed. Barsky recently published a study that found that in 2005, patients who were involved in testing drugs for depression responded to placebos way more than patients did back in the 1980s.
the placebo response was about twice as powerful than it was in the 1980s.
Let me repeat that. Placebos seem to be twice as effective today as they were 30 years ago.
That's a pretty significant difference.
Now, no one, including Barsky, really knows why the placebo effect appears to be changing. But Ted Kapchuk, another Harvard professor who studies the placebo effect full-time, says placebo drift, as it's now known, does appear to be real. He says it's shown up in more than just antidepressant trials. And one possible explanation, he says, is that there's been a change in our expectations. He points out that by 2005, for example, our belief in the power of antidepressants was very strong.
It was like, if you have depression, an antidepressant will make you feel much better. There's a lot of confidence, and that changed both provider's impression of what happens and changes, presumably, the patient's experience of what could happen.
But also, says Kapchuk, it could be that because drug companies mostly pay for drug experiments, doctors who do the research have a subtle incentive to say the drugs are working. And since doctors don't know who's really taking the pills and who's not, the fact that they tend to see improvement in test subjects would also mean that those on the placebo would look better. Then there's another possible explanation.
Researchers, especially in pharmaceutical industry-sponsored trials, get paid for every patient they recruit.
But often, says Kapchuk, it's just really hard to find people. So doctors will sometimes admit patients to trials who are not quite as sick as the trial requires, who simply aren't that depressed. And people who aren't that depressed are much more susceptible to the placebo effect.
It's really hard to recruit people. And, you know, if it's borderline, put them in. And those people on borderline at the end get a lower, get more, they are better in the placebo group.
Whatever the cause, placebo drift is something that has the potential to cause real mischief in medical trials. As Barsky points out,
if the placebo response, that baseline, is shifting all the time, then it really confuses the issue of whether the drug is effective or not.
The truth is that the process of science is just incredibly messy, messier than most people know. As for Annette and George Doshner, their experience with science has also been messy.
What did you do today? Anything special?
I watched a movie on TV.
George and Annette are older now, in their 60s. They live in Long Island, New York. Years ago, after learning that George had had the placebo operation, they decided to go back and get the real thing. And at first, Annette says, it worked great. The tremors went away.
And next thing, before you know it, he started getting wild movements, waggling of the arm or the left side or the right side. And we figured, what's wrong? The tremor is gone, but now this movement.
It got so bad that they went for another new kind of surgery, deep brain stimulation, which has quieted much of the shaking.
And that's what he has today, and he looks just fine. And we're very happy about it. We'd be happy if there was a cure, but we're hoping for that.
In fact, says Annette, if there was another potential cure, she thinks she and her husband might consider it.
Where there's life, there's hope. And there's always something coming out, either better medication, treatment, something. I believe in that.
Even, Doshner says, if it involves placebos. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
Let's move next to some research that has yet to pay off. For nearly 20 years now, scientists have been saying that successful gene therapies were just around the corner. We have yet to round that corner. Many scientists now admit they were probably a little too optimistic, but there are signs that these therapies will work for some diseases someday. NPR science correspondent Joe Pelka has more.
25 years ago, Mark Kay was finishing up a PhD in genetics and was preparing to enter medical school. He was intrigued by the notion of gene therapy, but he thought it might be a waste of time to enter the field because he still had 4 years of medical school to finish and then a medical residency.
And I thought by that time all the interesting diseases would be treated by gene therapy because the concept itself was so simple.
And the concept is simple. Some diseases are caused by damage to a single gene. Cystic fibrosis and hemophilia are examples. So give patients the healthy gene and the disease is cured, in theory. Mark Kay stuck with gene therapy and now runs the program at Stanford University. He says it turned out to be extremely difficult to get healthy genes into the cells that needed them.
If we saw one cell out of a million or even 10 million or 100 million that were genetically modified with the gene therapeutic, we would be excited.
It's no simple job to get genes into individual cells, but there is one organism that is extremely good at it. A virus.
What a virus does is it delivers its own genetic material to a cell.
Ken Cornetta says that's what viruses do when they infect cells. Cornetta is the president of the American Society of Gene and Cell Therapy.
What we can do in the setting of gene therapy is to re-engineer that virus to allow it to continue to do what it does best, which is deliver genetic material. But we can also remove the viral genes and replace it with the genetic material that we need to deliver to the cell to treat the disease.
But there were problems. When scientists used viruses to insert genes into patients, their immune systems tried to fight off the virus. And then, when the genes did get in some cases they switched on other genes that caused cancer, making the cure nearly as bad as the disease.
The field was in big trouble 10 years ago.
Joseph Glorioso is a researcher and editor of the journal Gene Therapy.
A lot of people were disillusioned, you know, oh, this can never work, we thought it was going to be easy and all that.
But Glorioso says gene therapists are a stubborn bunch, and despite the setbacks, many researchers kept at it. And finally, the field of gene therapy is seeing some positive results. Scientists have found new ways to modify viruses to make them better at delivering genes, and several gene therapy studies are having positive results. There's a therapy for a rare immune disorder called ADA deficiency, and more recently, scientists at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia reported dramatic success using gene therapy to treat a rare inherited form of blindness. It was a small study, only 12 subjects.
All of the subjects showed improvement.
Kathy High is a Howard Hughes investigator and one of the leaders of the study. She says the improvements were greatest for the children in the study, but a 44-year-old woman who was also in the study had better vision. High recalls talking to her and learning that she had a daughter who was a star softball player.
What she described is that she used to go to the games and her husband would sit next to her and do sort of a play-by-play. And about 2 months after she got the injection, she actually saw her daughter steal home in a game. And, you know, so, you know, that's really some of these stories I can never tell without getting emotional.
High says we should expect to hear more success stories in the coming months and years, and not just for rare disorders, but for more common diseases like AIDS and cancer.
But I really do think that the field, you know, after a long labor, is beginning to deliver. And so I think that that's good. I mean, it's a nice time to be working in this field.
Maybe now scientists' optimism is justified. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
One of the issues that's come up in the healthcare debate over and over isn't just the cost of our healthcare, it's what we're getting for that money. When it comes to drugs, doctors mostly prescribe them based on how well doctors think individual drugs actually work. Now, a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association says that in many cases, doctors don't have enough information to know which drug actually is the best. NPR's Joanne Silberner has more.
One night when physician Michael Hochman was in training, a patient came into the cardiac care unit. The senior doctor prescribed a drug. One of the other junior doctors wanted to know, why that drug?
And he really didn't have a good answer. And so I then asked, well, why do you prefer this medicine? And he said, it's just what I've always used, and it's what I'm used to using.
That didn't sound like a good answer to Hochman. As his training continued, though, he heard it more and more. With new drugs, sometimes the reason was, well, it looked good compared to placebo. When Hochman was done with his training, he and a colleague checked six of the leading medical journals. They picked out 328 recent studies on drugs.
Well, I learned what we expected we were going to learn going in, and that's that only a minority, 32% of all studies involving medications, are aimed at helping doctors use existing therapies more effectively.
The rest were more useful for marketing purposes. Descriptions of new drugs, comparisons to a placebo, no help to doctors trying to figure out whether to prescribe new drug X or old drug Y, or even, say, a non-drug option like exercise or physical therapy. And that's a problem, says Hochman. He's still prescribing drugs in the dark. In his research, Hochman found only two studies that looked at the price of drugs. He also found that most of the research that pits drugs in head-to-head competitions is funded by the government, not drug companies. That's understandable, says Jerry Avorn. He is a professor of medicine at Harvard and a frequent critic of drug companies.
Companies, understandably, are going to want to fund trials of their drugs or their devices that are going to highlight their product in the best possible way.
But he says doctors and patients need more information.
Given the state that our healthcare system's in, we really don't need more studies that just show that a drug is better than nothing. We need to know how does a particular drug compare with a choice that a doctor might make as an alternative, and also what's the best buy for the patient or for the taxpayer.
That information may be coming eventually. President Obama, in his stimulus package last year, set aside $1.1 billion to fund more head-to-head studies. In a commentary in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Alec O'Connor of the University of Rochester called for the FDA to consider comparative effectiveness studies when it considers new drugs. But that's going too far for Peter Pitts. He heads the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest, a group that gets funding from the drug industry. He says a drug that comes out a loser in a comparative effectiveness study may still work for some people, and doctors need that choice.
Asking the FDA to make comparative effectiveness a third leg in addition to safety and efficacy does not get the job done.
But others say the comparative information needs to be out there for consideration, so doctors like Michael Hochman can have comparative information on prescription drugs the same way consumers can get that kind of information when they're thinking about buying new cars or computers. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.
Head lice in children have been treated for years with lotions, creams, and shampoos, but lice are getting wise, becoming resistant to all of them. Now, in a study in the New England Journal of Medicine, researchers report that a tablet taken by mouth may be an alternative when standard treatments fail. NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
To say lice have been around a long time is something of an understatement, according to pediatrician Barb Frankowski.
They found head lice in mummies. Egyptian mummies.
Thousands of years ago, and they're still here. In large part, Frankowski says, because like most bugs, they evolve faster than the substances developed to kill them. And lice are definitely bugs, she says. An adult louse is about the size of a sesame seed.
If you look at it under the microscope, it looks like a little insect. You can see its mouth and its little legs, and you can actually tell if you're that good at it under the microscope whether it's a male or a female.
And the eggs that hatch, called nits, are extremely sturdy, sticking to the hair shaft, sort of like glue. Like a mosquito, lice survive by sucking blood. Only human blood, by the way. They don't like cats, dogs, or inanimate objects. For years, shampoos, cream rinses, and lotions that contain insecticides have killed off the lice. But that's changing, says Frankowski, who helped develop guidelines for pediatricians who treat lice. Lice have become resistant to treatment, she says, and that's why researchers from Europe looked at a powerful oral medication, which is now used to treat certain parasites in people, as well as worms in horses and dogs. Dermatologist Olivier Chosidov headed the study with patients whose lice weren't eradicated by topical treatments. He compared the drug ivermectin, which attacks the central nervous system of lice, to the prescription lotion malathion.
The lice are blood suckers.
So they absorb the ivermectin when they're feeding on blood. The drug is toxic to their central nervous system. Ivermectin is used once to kill off the lice and then about a week later to kill off any eggs. Chosidov, who has worked for various drug companies as a consultant, found ivermectin 10% more effective than the lotion. It was 95% successful in killing the hard-to-treat lice. The findings are promising, says pediatrician Cindy DeVore, who works with schools helping them treat children with lice.
But what we don't want to do is to jump in immediately using a very good, potentially stronger or more effective treatment when a lesser drug might do the same job. We don't want to bring out the big guns because we do not want head lice to develop resistance to ivermectin.
Ivermectin has not been approved by the FDA to treat head lice. European researchers agree with Dr. DeVore that if the drug is used in the U.S., it should be used only after shampoos, cream rinses, and prescription lotions have failed. And even though the study found no serious side effects, some health experts worry that because ivermectin works by destroying the nervous system of lice, it could be potentially harmful to people. Patty Naiman, NPR News.